Welcome to Season 3, Episode 6 of Swift Over Coffee. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Michaela Karen.
And in this episode, we discuss working on side projects.
Yeah, it's always figuring out why you really want to have a side project, like we talked about at the beginning.
Yes.
You definitely do not have to have one.
We share your views on whether we should be using Swift everywhere, or is it better to learn other languages too?
Right, so this is a whole it depends answer from Mark, which makes sense. He's a good senior developer. He knows his lines. Plus, it's definitely evil. It's definitely evil is what it is. And here, folks, normally would have some small talk about how Michaela's doing, how I'm doing, but no, this time. Before we start recording, I learned an invaluable tip, a time-saving tip from Michaela. I feel like I've wasted hours of my life for the last year or so. Michaela, what is this tip?
So Paul recently learned there's this pretty cool tool called Buffer that you can use to blast out social media posts to multiple different channels.
No, I knew about Buffer. I'm that slow. Come on, help me out here. But no, what she does is she uses it with Mastodon and Twitter. So I use Mastodon and Twitter a lot for posting social media stuff all the time, but I copy and paste to both places. And I, you know, put the picture up and add the alt text each time. It's a bit slow, but it matters because folks use different platforms. But you use that for everything, is that right?
Yeah, just about everything. If I'm tweeting or tooting or whatever, where I'm just posting something and not actually like tagging anybody, I typically just use Buffer and just blast it out to both like all the time.
This is so much of my life wasted. Because I always thought Buffer was like people who want to do marketing tweets and stuff, you know, just throw things out on a regulated basis once a day, yada, yada, yada. But no, you're just using it for general messages.
Yep, just...
Which is great. That's obvious in retrospect. And it's free, you said, basically, up to three networks, whatever it was, right?
Yeah, it's like three channels. You can then post whatever on all of those three, and you can post the same thing on all of them, too. So, like, iBlast, Twitter, and Mastodon, just because they're both text kind of platforms, but technically, I could include an image and blast that to my Twitter, Mastodon, and Instagram, like, all at the exact same time.
Right. This, honestly, there's an XKCD cartoon called 10,000 about exactly this kind of thing, about how we assume... people just know things, and when they don't, we can't make fun of them for doing it. And the cartoon, it sort of walks through the maths of how many folks a day learn something new. And their example they give is the Diet Coke and Mentos thing, you know, spraying everywhere Diet Coke, we put it there. And like 10,000 people a day, approximately, in the US alone, learned about that for the very first time. And you could go, aha, how could you possibly not know about Diet Coke and Mentos? Or you could be like, well, the quote says, you're one of today's lucky 10,000. Actually, part of that learning experience. So today, you've helped me be part of my learning journey to waste less of my life typing things into tiny little text boxes and websites. Well done.
The more you know. So there have been some exciting things that have been released lately since our last episode. So I think the first and biggest one that's funnily enough that I haven't actually checked out is Apple just came out with a brand new project for the Vision Pro called the Swift Splash.
Yeah, and it's really, really cute. And I'm not sure what the bigger play is, how they're trying to market this for developers. But right now, I'm happy to see great stuff being made. And it's a beautiful little app. We have to kind of build a little water ride for a fish, cute little fish, and it's in its little goldfish bowl, living a happy life. But no, you're going to send this fish down a perilous trip with water slides and stuff. It's a bit like the old sort of Roller Coaster Tycoon kind of games from a few years ago.
Yeah.
You build spins and turns, try and get it towards the end thing, all in your, you know, kitchen, wherever it is you're using your Vision Pro. And so it's a lot of fun. They've obviously had a lot of fun making it. Someone's had a really good time making it. And I hope it inspires, I don't know, games or ideas. I remember seeing the earliest iPhone sample demos from Apple. They made like a metronome, for example, a really nice metronome app for iPhone OS back then. And unsurprisingly, a bunch of folks took that and made metronome apps that were really, really good because they had a good starting point to work from. So maybe that's part of it as well, just kind of giving folks good sample code.
Yeah, that's what I really like about the Apple project is they're trying to tell you this is the way we want you to write the code, even though sometimes they're not the best. It kind of just, you know, depends on what it is. But we have no precedent on how Vision Pro like apps should be written. Like people have done some ARKit and RealityKit, but like on Vision Pro, the way that they wrote like their Hello World program is like dramatically different than how I've written like Vision Pro code like so far, basically.
For sure. I think particularly here, they're trying to show off exact techniques, one of which was a lot of Reality Composer Pro, where you can do a lot of work there, folks. I know you're thinking, oh, I've got to use GUIs and stuff, but in this tool Apple have made, you can build some really impressive scenes just by clicking and dragging your way around. Previewing particles, for example, looks really, really good. Without going near code, just get an idea of how this thing might look as a starting point. But they also talk about things like how to parallelize loading of assets, because in this case, they're loading quite a lot of stuff from Reality Composer. And that's, I know it's an M2 chip inside the Vision Pro, but it's still a fairly small chip with a limited battery life, so you don't want to waste too much time. And so they work very, very hard in making that as fast as possible using async await. So I think they're trying to show us, please take the time to optimize this carefully and use this kind of tool carefully. And hopefully folks pay attention. I hope they do.
We'll see. I wonder what it would look like if you have the Vision Pro and it's like all laggy or something. Like, would that just immediately make you dizzy? Or is it just going to be you're sitting there and nothing loads, so you're just like looking around?
So I'd like to imagine that the way the Vision Pro is architected is very much the same way that things like Siri integration works on iPhone. Your code can run as slow as it wants to, but it won't slow down Siri. It won't block Siri. So the screen you're seeing of the real world around you, other things that are running, will run in a separate thread from your own app running around it. So hopefully, even if your stuff lags, you won't get weird, glitchy camera movement. That would make you sick very, very quickly. It might make your app, of course, look bad. And I suspect, certainly at launch, we'll see a fair amount of that because there aren't many devices going around. And in fact, just today, I saw, it was like one of those Tim Cook emails that gets leaked by everyone online saying they're looking forward to bringing Vision Pro to the US next year. And so I suspect that I won't even be able to buy one not being in the US.
Ooh.
And so folks like me or anyone, obviously the rest of the whole world, who want to build apps for Vision Pro, we can have a go at building apps. We can't even tell it works effectively for potentially 6 months after the main launch. So I am thinking, yes, we'll see a few sort of glitchy, slow, buggy frame rate drops and so forth initially, but hopefully it'll out of time.
Also, I know the iOS 17.1 beta just dropped recently too.
And you love betas, right?
I have them. I need to check. I filed a feedback report about like an issue with the new AirDrop kind of feature and dropping like specific kind of files. And I filed that back in like the 17.0 beta like 3 or something like that.
Oh,
but I haven't tested it since then. So like I still haven't like figured out if it actually works or not yet. So I'll have to do that with this beta, but we're still waiting on things with it, right?
It's so hard for us to, I think, visualize how long it takes for Apple to fix things because, we file a bug in beta 3. We think, oh yeah, beta 4 might be in there. No. They finished beta 4 2 weeks before you even filed your bug probably. And then beta 5, beta 6, they've got a chance of maybe fixing it. And then 17.1, maybe they will actually do it. There's a big lead time because of the size of it. Just triaging the bugs, nailing it down, finding a fix, testing across all different kinds of devices and languages and regions and locales. And there's a huge amount of work to go through. And so there's a lot. Which maybe explains why we're still missing things. We're still missing like the journal app, which is in the dub keynote. You and iOS 17, the journal app. And of course, someone wears it and it's still not actually landed.
It will just appear on your home screen one day.
It will.
And we will all just be like, where'd that come from?
I know.
Who put this here?
Yeah, I know. Oh, it's a new U2 album. I think they just did correctly announce the double tap for WatchOS. Is there?
Oh, that's out
now?
That was the thing.
In the beta, yeah, that was the major new feature in the new watches. Oh, double tap, and it seems to be basically automatic based on the button position. There's no actual API just for that.
Oh wow, that's interesting. Yeah. Also, in talking about betas, is this one the beta or this is the final version? Is we now have SF Symbols 5?
That's now out of beta. Just happened out of beta like a week or two ago. As we're recording this. And I think because of the way it works, if you're on the beta version, you might not get the, they have a built-in app store, the system setting upgrade system for Safari upgrades and often SF Symbols. But if you're on the beta, you might not get that. You might be still on the beta version. So I want to delete that and grab the new version just to make sure you have the latest version of SF Symbols.
Does SF Symbols, does that also like show you all the new animated symbols? So like you'll see what the animations could be?
You do, yeah. Oh, it's really nice. The app is actually lovely. I still don't quite understand what they're going for with the app, because it doesn't never quite works the way our brain expects. Like, if I'm at SF Symbols, I'm looking at stuff. It's not like an alphabetical order. It's in some other order. And I don't quite know what the order is. I wish it would just show me things in a sensible way, but it doesn't do. I don't know why. So there's some hidden order that I'm not seeing that it's ordered in somehow. I don't know. So our theme for this episode is about side projects. How to think them up, how to find time to work on them, how to promote them, how to market them, how to actually make them work very well. And first up, folks, I want to say one thing out of the block. You don't have to have side projects. Like, sometimes you see folks do these like clickbaity kind of I'm a Twitter influencer kind of thing where they're like, I hire real coders who think about code all the time. They go home and they do more code. They come to work and do more code. And that doesn't have to be you. If you just do like 9 to 5 coding for money, crack on. Awesome. I love it. If you want to do side projects, you can do. If you love doing that, I really enjoy them. I know Michaela does too. Then go for that too. But it's not like one size fits all. This happens what we like doing. But if you think, I hate side projects, cool. You go snowboarding, or you go and play guitar, or you do a spare time instead. You do that because life's brilliant. Anyway, that's my rant over. Side projects.
It's like right before we're talking about side projects, like, don't worry. It's okay though. Because yeah, I don't know what I was saying. Where I was going with that, but that's funny.
Well, think about it. I mean, you know, not many apps make it big.
That's true.
Like, become multi-million.
I think
apps,
side projects,
right?
Is also
a few thousand,
like an iOS or like sort of a mobile thing. Just because the world we are in at the moment is like mobile development.
Yeah.
But it's like a side project for like a back-end developer or like even front-end. Like, yes, you can spin up a website. That's fun. But like somebody who does mainly like API work or some kind of back-end dev, like spinning up a whole like database and like a bunch of other different services is like a whole different ball game than just file new in Xcode and then suddenly you have a... So it's just like, I feel like this is a mobile thing that people do more so than other tech stacks, maybe too.
Maybe. Or, I mean, certainly it feels more like the games industry when you've got an idea for a quick little platform or something you want to make real fast or whatever, a word game, you can put it together really, really fast. And you're absolutely right. The number of side projects I've had in my life has shot up like 100-fold since I switched to iOS development, because it's just there. Xcode is just like one click away and I bang, got a new side project straight away. And with SwiftUI and SwiftData and SwiftCharts, but it's so easy to make side projects. It does most of the work for you. It's got to fill in the gaps and boom, you're away. It is, yeah, I find it really addictive.
Yeah, it's my current side project that I'm doing is also, it was just kind of like a file new project, spin up like a quick little idea, and then I'm participating in an event that's called Hacktoberfest. So this is all about contributing to open source projects. So this is an app I built, like a super, super minimal MVP. And then I open the app up for Hacktoberfest so that other people can now contribute to the app. And so with that, it's that means I now not only have to, like, I can do coding on the project itself. I now am reviewing PRs and everything, and like other people are contributing to the code base as well, too.
And fortunately, this is a project where you love the idea very much. It's a real personal hobby for you, right?
Oh, no. You're exposing. I don't actually. So it's really funny. For anybody who doesn't know, I have a project. It's called Basic Car Maintenance. And I called this because I'm not into cars. Like, I barely, like, practically maintain my own car rather than, you know, put gas in it. And every so often, you know, you have to take it through. Oh, my gosh. I almost said the dry cleaners, the car wash. And you just have to, you know, wash your car. And that's, like, straight up about the most maintenance that I do on my car.
Yeah.
But I was looking at selling my car and they were like, oh, when was the last time you got into an accident? When was the last time you had any, like, repairs and stuff? And I was like, I did it. Write that down. It is somewhere. I don't even know where to look to find those answers. So I was like, okay, I need a place to write down this information. So it kind of started like that. And also the idea really mainly came from one of my friends as well. They started building this. And then later I had asked if I could like take this idea and kind of just run with it too. But yeah, it's super basic, but it started off basic. And now with Hacktoberfest, we are currently recording this on Friday the 13th. And so we still have more of like the whole other half of October to go, but we've already blown through my like initial MVP that I was planning on doing. So I'm kind of in the stage right now where I'm trying to figure out what do we want to do with the project? But I also have like 10 GitHub notifications I have to look through. So I can't really think about what's next before I get through like the current open PRs.
Well, maybe the PRs can become suggestions for future features that folks can work on.
Yeah, people can suggest any feature on so I'm using GitHub primarily because I have a GitLab account, but I don't really use it. I mainly just everything I do is on GitHub. So you can create issues on like something specific you want to work on. If you want to add UI tests, add like something like that. But then also GitHub, I think it's a relatively new feature called like GitHub Discussions, where it's basically now like a forum. So you can like post an idea, people can comment, and it can have like a whole threaded comments. And it's different than just like an issue you see like in any other project where it's just like this gigantic thread of like just one line threads, and it's not like indented at all. So you can't have like slight, you know, little separate conversations here and there. But that's what I've been doing at the moment, which is a lot of PR review, which is like a different way of a side project because, you know, it's I'm not doing as much coding myself. It's other people are contributing code. But then it's I do have to understand what they are writing. Otherwise, I'm not sure how I would maintain the project.
Yes.
Like a big part just by myself right now.
Yeah, for sure. Sure. It sounds like you made a lot of work for yourself. Well done.
Yes, this is all self-inflicted work.
But helping a lot of folks make contributions too and get comfortable with Git and working together with other people and so forth, which is also important.
Yeah, and that's the primary objective I had really with the project itself, is just get other people involved with open source. And then if you're brand new to just iOS development and just learning on your own, you never really get that aspect of actually using Git in a real collaborative environment like you would do at a job. You don't get that learning on your own or like pretty much taking any self-directed course.
I'll give you a great tip I got from Ash Furrow years ago. He said, when someone submits a great patch or two patch or three patch, whatever, he makes them a collaborator on the repository, because that way they also get ownership and buy into the project for future changes, but then they can help review and merge other changes. So the team grows in size from like 1 to 8 or 9 fairly quickly. People who really want to contribute, and actually that helps invite more folks in. And that works really, really well. People do accept the buy-in very quickly, I've found.
Ooh, I should probably check that out, because at the moment, I think I have like 10 open PRs, which is so many. But
it is, and the problem is I get a whole bunch too, and I feel bad because I haven't got time to review them all regularly. And so they kind of sit there for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks. And it's actually kind of off-putting for folks who put so much love and time and work creating a pull request for an open source thing, you know, thankless work, right? Mm-hmm. For them to sort of hear nothing back because I'm busy doing other pull requests, other code or other, it's hard.
Yeah, that's something I'll definitely look into, because it's been way, what is it? Like more overwhelming than I was expecting, because I had a Hacktoberfest project that I did the past 2 years, and it used an API that sadly got killed. So I had to also kill the app itself.
Oh, okay.
So with that though, it's over the course of 2 years, I had about 20 people contribute. But this year, in the first 3 days, I had 10 people contribute. So I was like, oh my gosh, this was way more popular in the first 3 days. And then now we're almost at like 2 weeks, we've had 30 people. And it has just been wild seeing like how many people have found the project. And I have like different people assigned to every single issue, because I don't want two people working on the same issue.
Right.
Because people, then you have to figure out how to collaborate with someone you have no idea who they are or anything. And that's really difficult. But then also I scope the issues very small, so that when you're working on something, it's like maybe 100 line or so change. You're not doing anything that like drastically affects the entire code base mainly.
So do you think you're getting more people because it's about cars, or more folks because you're obviously very famous now?
That's a good question. I don't know. I do think that has a factor into it, is that I do now have more followers and I just talk to more people nowadays than I did in the last 2 years, because I now have an iOS dev job and everything too. And I didn't have that previously when I first did all of these projects. So I think that could be part of it. But also I think some of it is that I have talked about this project since like August. Mm. So like I started talking about it before even the Hacktoberfest website was up for the year.
Right.
So like the only people who knew about it, if you would only know about Hacktoberfest if you had participated in it previously. Because if you went to their website, it would just, it was showing like all last year's information. So you would kind of just be like, I don't know what this is. But because I've been talking about it, I think that has really like made more awareness around what the project itself yes. is, because I'm talking about iOS dev and tips and stuff like that on most of my social media. But then now, the last couple months or so, all I've been talking about is Hacktoberfest. So I think that like exposure itself is kind of what has drawn people to the project.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting, talking about stuff I find is as encouraging for me as other people. Like I feel when I publicly commit to something, the need to actually deliver on what I've said, if that makes sense, you know, to stick to what I've said I'm going to do. When I say I'm doing this, now it's something I've got to work towards or get as close as I can. And, you know, I used to went through a massive phase years ago of doing side project, every single day, just fire new project. I got very, very comfortable saying a blank Xcode project, saying, what should I do now? Again. And then eventually a few worked. I wrote over 100 apps in the space of a year, and then a handful worked really well. One particular one took off and is still today, 7 years on, but I haven't changed it in 7 years, still very popular. Because I got lucky in the right space at the right time, built the right app, and I should really work in it again to try and make it even better. But it's like before, there's no iPhone 10 capacity. You know, I still get the black bar top and bottom for iPhone 10. There's no iPad multitasking. It's before iPad multitasking, so you don't get that either. And it's still wildly popular. And I go, I should work in it, but I should also leave it alone because it's doing really well still.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. Because I would love to have a project that's like that, because it's Hacktoberfest right now for me is like a sprint. Right. So I'm just like merging as many PRs, merging as many issues and everything. And I haven't thought really what happens after this. I'm guessing what I'm going to do is go clean up some code and kind of, my goal is to ship it, so it will be on the App Store. And that, I think, is my favorite part about it, because we made a new list so you can see all the contributors to the project, too.
Nice.
So you can now see, like, everybody who's contributed to the project, click on their GitHub profile. And that, I think, is really fun, because if you don't have the means or don't want to go about making your own whole app and whole idea and put that up on the App Store, you can be like, hey, I contributed to this project that's on the App Store. Like, scroll here. Yes. Look, that's my name right
sure.
there.
For sure.
And you can then start talking about what features you integrated to.
Well, people who are working towards portfolio still counts for that, doesn't it? It all counts towards something.
Yeah. That's what I'm thinking too.
Right now, my main side project, I haven't actually mentioned this to anybody, never mind Twitter, nothing at all. My main side project's one I'm making with my kids, for my kids, for school stuff. So there's a big emphasis in many, many schools here in the UK and also in the US. If it's a selective school, if they can select the students to go in, they give them a whole bunch of tests. The, you know, like CAT test, for example, common assessment test.
Yeah.
They do maths tests, they do English tests, they do what we call verbal reasoning and nonverbal reasoning. And I've made this app with hundreds of different variations of math questions and also nonverbal reason questions. So it says, like, you know, here are like various shapes, which one's the odd one out kind of thing. It does many, many, many variations of this for my kids to work through. And it's brilliant. And I'm thinking, I should probably put this online somewhere because it's so good. I should probably share this with somebody. But I'm also thinking it's never going to make that much money. Like, they're going to be wildly popular. So is it worth the work? I'm not sure. So I'm kind of umming and ahhing right now, but putting the time and effort to make it more polished for public consumption. We'll see.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, thinking about, do you want to make it so it fits the use case that you had? Or do you want to make it, more publicly available so that it helps other people as well that could possibly go outside the original scope that you had to?
Yeah, and the sad thing is, and this is true for you too, if you live in any rich country, you're thinking, well, I might make $1,000 a month from this. And that's good money. But if you live in like my wife's home country, Hungary, that's a good salary. Live in New York, that's not a good salary. And so your desire to do all this work in exchange for $1,000 a month, which includes, you know, maintenance time in the future, you're like, is it worth it? Whereas right now, I'm thinking, I'm making this app for my kids. It's not about the money, is it? It's about me helping my kids. And that is more valuable to me than the promise of income. And so I think I might lose momentum a little bit if I start doing it for money, because I'm like, it's not actually worth the money, you know?
Yeah, it's always figuring out why you really want to have a side project. Like we talked about at the beginning, you definitely do not have to have one, but figuring out why you want to do that, because if you're just doing it to kind of just do it, you'll end up doing whatever project then be like, I hate this. This is no fun. I should rewrite it. And it's just like, you just don't know where you want to go with the project itself. And it's like, you can just learn something to learn it. That's totally fine. And that's kind of where side projects really shine. It's just spin something up that you've never done before.
Yeah.
But if you really want to like market it and then actually make it into something that you're trying to make money off of it, that has like a completely different perspective and mindset of what you're trying to do with it too.
Yeah, it's sustainable. You've polished it. Like, for example, my eldest daughter is making a game right now. And her goal for the game is she wants to make money.
I love it.
That's the goal for the game. It. And I'm like, am I teaching her evil skills, basically? No. Because she watches some of my live streams on Hacking Stuff Plus sometimes. And one of the live streams she really enjoys, it's a game where you just tap the screen, it fires a ball and it bounces off various targets, and you try and use your ball to try and clear targets as it goes. One touch kind of puzzle game. And she's like, I want to make that into a bigger, more complicated game. But she wants to use there's a game out there called Two Dots, there's a few of them out there, Candy Crush and similar, where you play the game, and if you lose the game, you lose a life, and you've got to wait 3 hours to get a life back kind of thing, or pay money now to unlock a life and play. That's the model she wants to clone. I think it's an evil model, but she's like, eh. So I don't know. I want to support her in that and help her make the game, but at the same time, thinking, is it evil? I don't really know.
I think it's because that's what we see in a lot of apps. Like, I've recently been doing Duolingo. I currently have an 81-day streak because it's on my lock screen, so I'm looking at it. And they do that exact same thing. And I think it's funny. They have like their own, it's not like an actual ad from an ad framework, but it's their own video that they play that tells you to upgrade to like Super Duolingo, and you watch it every single day. Ooh. And it's just like, it would be weird to watch a paywall every single time like you start some new lesson or some new task, like entering something into an app. It would be weird to hit a paywall every single time. But it's because it's been gamified, and games also have so many different like ways that they monetize too. Yeah. It's, I don't know.
But there they have things like you get a streak protection purchase, can't you?
Yeah.
So they know the streak matters. They've gamified keeping the streak. And what I know it's a scam is when I go to a game and it's like, you can buy 10,000 Smurf berries, 20,000 Smurf berries, 50,000 Smurf berries, or like 500 diamonds, or 100 gold coins. And there's like multiple different miniature currencies inside there because they're all doing different things. So you cannot actually pay a little bit and get a lot. You got to pay a lot to get a little bit. That's when it feels scary.
Yeah.
And it's worse. Actually, this random rant for you here. Side projects. Not side projects at all. Random rant for you. I played games as a kid a long, many, many moons ago. And some of them have come back onto iOS as scamware. And the worst one's a game called Lemmings. And some folks hearing this go, oh, Lemmings. I remember Lemmings. What a brilliant, brilliant game. It was brilliant. It was a funny, creative, beautiful puzzle game. I think made in Liverpool. And what happened was they took the IP of it, mashed it up, and made it into scamware, buy Smurfberry diamonds, whatever it is, to unlock stuff. Very, very annoying. A beautiful one-off purchase game before is now just like rinsing folks for money. So it's definitely evil. It's definitely evil is what it is.
Wow, this has turned dark. We started talking about side projects, and now we're talking about don't be scammy in your side projects if you're going to monetize.
I was speaking to someone a few days ago who was building an app for his friend who suffers from migraines. And the app, you basically say, I've got a migraine. It's a bad one or a middle one or a mild one, whatever it's to be. And you note down in there things like, I had this to eat. I got this much sleep. I had these kind of medications. With an attempt to try and find any links in your life that might lead towards migraines. And straight away, I'm thinking, what a brilliant, brilliant app idea, generally, side project or not. What a brilliant idea, because I love it when someone takes all their coding skills and use it to solve some kind of real world problem. And don't get me wrong. I think, you know, any kind of app is great fun to work with. And I'm sure Sophie's game would be great fun too. But when someone said, I've got an idea for this, and I can really make a difference here for someone with migraines, a very serious issue, amazing. And so I do encourage folks, have a side project if you can, because there are folks out there who love to have your skills, love to do what you can do and apply it to their real world problems. Even if it's free, it doesn't have to make money. Obviously making money is helpful, but it doesn't have to be.
Our open ballot question that we had this episode is, should we be using Swift everywhere, or is it better to learn other languages too? So first off, we had a ton of opinions.
A ton.
You all have a lot of opinions about Swift
for
a podcast where we talk about Swift.
Who knew?
And now we're asking, don't use Swift or should you use Swift everywhere? It's kind of funny. So let's kick it off though with Florian Schweizer. So he already knows Swift, so why would I not use other tools I'm familiar with to solve problems? As long as Swift is capable of solving the problem, he's going to stick with it, and his most precious resource is time. And it is a good investment if I have to learn a new language just to do X, Y, Z. And I agree, depends on your goals. Like we were talking with side projects, it kind of just all depends on what your goal is with what you're doing. But if your goal is to build something really quick, you already know Swift, might as well just use it if it works.
That's the thing. I think we as Swift developers, and as you said earlier, we are very easy to get into side projects because there's right there, right? There are so many great ideas still waiting for us to tap on and mine and work with. So I can see folks going, yeah, there's cool problems on the web, but that takes a whole bunch of time, resources, hassle, learning React or Python or PHP, whatever. I can just futz around Swift and have a great time. And yeah, that is a good investment of time because it's right there. It's Xcode and Vision OS and iOS and Mac OS. It's right there, one click away. And actually, that's very similar to what Marco Ponce said.
Oh, yeah. He said, if you just started programming, use Swift only. And once you have a good grasp of a core programming concept, learn another language to challenge what you already know. And then determine if Swift is the best tool to solve your problem.
Right. So this is a whole it depends answer from Mark, which makes sense. He's a good senior developer. He knows his lines. but it's interesting that it's true. I remember at school learning languages, you know, English, French, German, Spanish, whatever. And they don't, at least in the UK at the time, they didn't really do a very good job of teaching you various English terms for things, like how our verbs are constructed and our adjectives and whatever. But when you learn a second language, like French or perhaps Spanish in the US, they say, oh yeah, so now we're going to look at the imperfect tense, for example. You learn what these things actually mean and how they work. But you can't get there very easily unless you can speak something first. You're like, well, why do I need a verb tense? What does this mean? Why do I have to have multiple past tenses, for example, or future tense? So get somewhere, get a grasp of something so you can say words, so you can build apps somehow. You can see how things are used in practice, but then start jumping around. So if you had gone, you know, in the first 10 days, 2 weeks, oh, let's do a bit of Python, let's do a bit of PHP, a bit of JavaScript, you're going to get kind of screwed up a little bit. Nothing will really click at that early stage in your life. Get somewhere first, feel solid, and then experiment.
Yeah, that's like the phrase, know enough to be dangerous. So you know enough that you can do some things, but you don't know it like super in depth. But if you're dangerous enough, you can kind of start going through like a bunch of different things in a lot of different languages too.
Yeah.
I think then Philip Nemechek also has like a similar opinion on this too, is he uses backend with Python and Django, and he's super happy with that decision, although he could have used Swift. But he wanted to try branching out on his style and then just see what there is in different communities as well and getting out of that Swift like safety net. Yeah, I agree with this too. It's once you branch out of one programming language, you can use one programming language for one specific thing. Like we always use Swift with iOS development and then all the different Apple platforms. But then branching out to something like Python and Django, Python is used in a bunch of different things too. So it's not really like a same one domain kind of thing. And what you really get out of that too is you have so many different communities that use a language for a bunch of different things. And getting to see that is really interesting too. And it's just not something you really get if you only stayed within Swift.
Yeah, this answer is actually very, very interesting. I remember interviewing one of the lead Django developers years ago, back when I did magazines. His name's Jacob Kaplan-Moss. And he told me how the Django team build their APIs. I was like, damn, that's obvious in retrospect. Why don't I do that? And the idea was simple. They write their documentation first for how the API is going to work, and then write the code to make the API actually work that way. So it's like documentation-driven development as opposed to test-driven development. They craft their APIs as, here's the ideal way, we think, of doing this thing. Not the way we ended up with because we strung together A, B, C, and D code. This is the ideal way, and then figure out how to make the code actually deliver that API. And that's it's a lovely way of building software. Think about the user first, or in our case, the developer user, or how to access APIs, and then go backwards from there. And that's a cultural thing. You know, getting that in the Django community as an idea of this is how we build APIs, folks, is important. And so, yeah, Philip's right. I think seeing how different style of development works matters.
Yeah, I like that because it's we as the developers are the ones using these APIs. So it's what is it? The term is like developer experience. So instead of it like user experience or user interaction, it's more developer experience of do developers like using your API? Because if it's like awful to use, nobody will want to use it.
Yeah. And by the way, folks, if anyone from Apple's listening, let me give you feedback number 6000659, which I filed the same thing multiple times. I'm being a bit cheeky, but it's asking for a modern equivalent API for UI text checker, the way we do spelling error detection on iOS. It is a horrifyingly old school Objective-C API, which you can get wrong in Swift so easily because it has to use NS ranges. You can't use sumstring.count. You got to do sumstring.utf16.count. Otherwise, it'll miscount emoji. It's really grim. And I filed that in 2016. And so as we're recording this, Apple's Hack Week internally is coming up soon. Please, folks, take pity on us. Think about how to use your hideous old APIs. And give them a little bit of a refresh, please.
I love that you remembered this bug that you filed from 2016 and were ready with the feedback number immediately.
I harassed them in person at Dev. I'm like, hey, have you seen this feedback number? Like, no, look at this. It's annoying.
And that also moves into how Oliver Binns described how his team works now too, is they are moving from the process of a separate mobile and backend team into three cross-discipline teams. So they'll be encouraging senior devs mostly to have a basic knowledge of the entire stack from iOS, Android, web, and backend so that they can help others. But then you have all the other developers who are now doing more feature-based work as opposed to domain-based work too.
Yeah, this is actually surprisingly hard to do. I think sometimes team members start to worry about their future employability a little bit. If they're thinking, well, if I'm doing a third of my time in backend or a third of my time in Kotlin, am I still a great iOS expert or not? But equally, I'm a big believer that nothing's wasted. You know, the things you learn from Kotlin, from Python, JavaScript, whatever, you'll get ideas there and thieve them wholesale. Like the great artist steal thing that Jobs kept on repeating again and again and again. Good ideas are elsewhere to take them, steal them, and apply them in your iOS code, and you'll be stronger for it, I think.
Yeah, and that directly correlates with what Alex Bonder has mentioned too. He's been a React developer for 5 years, and he also is learning Swift for fun, but he knows other languages too, like C, Python, Ember, Ruby, and anything that comes up. So once you start learning different languages, you see the quirks each language has too. But at the core, everything is just logic, which is absolutely true too, because while we have all these different programming languages, what's the point of all of them? We're trying to do like similar things with all of these different languages. So I always tell like beginners who are brand new to coding like this, it's like, definitely stick to one, but remember that once you do know one, you can branch out because an if statement is the exact same in every single language.
This reminds me, and this is like second XKCD in a single episode. There's an XKCD on exactly this too about competing standards because people go, oh, there's 14 competing standards. And then someone says, that's stupid. We've got to make a new universal standard. And now there are 15 competing standards, right? It just expands, expands, expands. So you're saying, why do we need all these languages? Let's build one language to rule them all. And of course, now's another language just floating around. But I do agree with what Alex is saying. The core is the same. The logic is the same. If loops and whatever are the same. Yes, Swift happens to leverage a wide spread of features. So for people who aren't used to like first-class functions, for example, they get a bit confused at first. Oh, what can I do? What's a closure? It has optionals and more critically has non-optionals, which is very, very nice. And that's spreading as well. So it's fairly cutting edge in that respect, which is nice. That makes it a bit of a ramp up more than, say, JavaScript would have.
Yeah, and that's with that case XKCD comment as well. That leads into what Aaron LeBeau mentions, which is no language lives forever. So spread your wings to other languages makes you more attractive than ever in an ever-changing job market.
Years ago, and this is I'm name-dropping terribly again and again and again. I interviewed a chap called Jeremy Allison, who produced a very widespread tool called Samba, which is an open-source reimplementation of the Microsoft networking protocol SMB for Linux and other platforms. I think it's actually used by macOS somewhere as well. And he had a brilliant view on this. He was saying, listen, years and years ago, I learned Unix, I learned POSIX, I learned OpenGL, I learned C. And I also, since then, I've learned C Sharp, I've learned Windows Forms, I've learned .NET, I've learned da-da-da-da. And he said, it's very interesting that the things he learned a long time ago, some of them, C, POSIX, and da-da-da, are still exactly the same. They haven't changed at all. You can still sit down and write great projects with them and great programs with them. Whereas other things, like Microsoft particularly, kind of come and go very quickly. And they go, oh, this is a new thing. It's called Silverlight, for example. It's going to exist and it'd be great. And then it's gone a few years later. And then, oh, another new thing. That's something that's great. And then that's gone again. And it is sadly the case there's more of the latter than there is the former. Things tend to come and go fairly quickly. The languages I learned first were things like Visual Basic and Delphi or Object Pascal and PHP and da-da-da. And Objective-C, of course. And that isn't really used anymore. I don't write any Objective-C. I haven't done in years. I haven't done Object Pascal in years. I haven't done Visual Basic in years. It's not wasted, but how long is Swift going to last? Like, if you were really optimistic, you'd say 20 more years. And that's really optimistic because it's already been around. We're about to approach Swift's 10th anniversary. That would make a 30-year-old language. That's a heck of an old language. I don't think it'll hit that. That's like small talk, you know, Objective-C length. That's had a long, long life, but I suspect it won't live that long. So spreading your wings.
That reminds me real quick, too, is how somebody was asking if anybody has a Swift tattoo. Like, if anybody just has one. I saw, I think, two or so people that have one. But then also somebody else came in, Ivars Myers, and he had said that he doesn't have a Swift tattoo, but he has an Xcode tattoo. Because you have to use Xcode for actual, like, the programming itself, even though the language itself could change.
Fair.
Casey Liss also mentions, too, that if we're talking about you should spread your wings and learning new languages helps with learning, he mentions that it also helps with existing problems in new ways. So when he first learned Objective-C, it helped him take a different perspective to the C-sharp programming that he was writing at the same time. And then same story with learning Swift. It doesn't mean that he made his C-sharp code look like Objective-C necessarily, but it helped evaluate problems and solutions with a wider perspective. Because, yeah, that's an issue when you're so focused in a single language. You can sometimes try to write that language when you switch to a different one, try to write it in the same way as, like, your first language. So I know C and C Sharp and SQL, but you don't, like, SQL, the programming language, which has to do with databases, is completely different in how you write it than, like, how you'd write Swift code. And so, like, you can't force yourself to write SQL in a Swifty way. Because it's, like, not possible. But it's the same thing when you're going across different domains, too. It's probably easier to write Swift code in a Swifty way to something like C Sharp, where the syntax is relatively similar. You just have semicolons.
I think I mentioned this in the previous episode, but my earliest Objective-C was really hideous Objective-C. I'm not saying I wrote great Objective-C by the end of it, but my earliest stuff was terrifyingly bad Objective-C. Because the apps I was shipping were apps I'd made previously on other platforms. So I made this huge puzzle game, like mini game collection for Windows Phone, which used C-sharp 2 and .NET Mobile, so really old stuff. I then ported it across to OpenGL for SDL, for Linux, then ported that to Xbox 360 with DirectX, and then took that mishmash and ported it to iPhone. And what I didn't want to do is rewrite any of my actual code. So I left all the minigame stuff in pure C++ and then just did tiny little shims across from Objective-C to C++ code, the least possible code I could do. It was horrifying. I had no idea what I was doing. I shipped it. It made money. It worked. But it was pure luck that it worked, quite frankly. It was real tin cans and bits of string holding it all together. But see, I had the same opposite problem Casey did. My Objective-C looked very much like C++ because it basically was C++.
It's a transformer.
But ultimately, though, he's right. The idea is correct. You'll get new perspectives. Folks, if you only have learned Swift, if you've only used Xcode, please don't think you're dealing with the best language, dealing with the best IDE. There are lots of things we can get from other places. My wife's grandfather is Hungarian, And he said to me once, you know, Paul, you should learn Hungarian. Hungarian is the most beautiful language in the world. And he only speaks Hungarian, only spoke Hungarian. And like, of course it is. If you only have one language, it's the best thing in the world, right? That's what it's going to be. Swift is good. I love Swift. I love Swift UI. I love Xcode. But there are other IDEs out there. We don't have all the ideas in our little community. We haven't got all the best talks in our little conference circuit. Get ideas from elsewhere and steal them, steal them, steal them. And that's why go to Evolution. Go and read the alternative considered. Go and see how like Rust solves it or Python solves it and get ideas from there. Because the Swift team certainly are.
Yeah, that reminds me on the Swift Evolution. I remember seeing when they were implementing async await, but you also have a function that can throw as well. The syntax they landed on is try await, but it's not await try. Mm-hmm. And then you can read the reasoning behind why they chose to just put those keywords in that specific order.
Yeah.
And that's such like an interesting thing that when you're learning brand new, you don't think of, oh, why did they decide to do something like this? Because other languages then, they like call upon like how other ones do it and what they like or dislike out of that too.
Yeah, actually right now it's interesting because they're talking about earliest stages, talking about doing typed throws in Swift. We haven't had that ever since it was introduced in Swift 2 in the first place. We just say throws some kind of unknown error. And the Swift team have been adamant, we don't want typed throws. It never works. It was a completely backfired in Java. Terrible idea. And now they're like, we should have typed throws. And so I wonder what's made them finally move. What's made their perspective shift? I don't actually know. I guess we'll find out soon enough.
And that leads on to how Matt Thomas mentions that learning concepts from other languages can help you then be a better Swift programmer. So things like higher order functions like map and reduce, async await, regex, all appear in other languages before Swift. But luckily, familiarity with them make it easier to adopt Swift then too.
Yes, definitely. That is absolutely true. I want to quit a quick shout out to regular expressions, regexes. I personally love them. I know some folks fear them. I'm a massive, massive geek about them. I love them very much. For me, this really hit home with Swift UI because bizarrely, like in 2016, whenever it was, I was like, oh, what's this React thing? Whenever it was, 2017, I don't remember what year it was. What's this React thing? I want this React thing. This looks really interesting on the web with JavaScript and TypeScript and Babel and da-da-da. And I got massively into React, like exploring it left, right, and center. The whole idea of reactive programming, declarative programming, blew my mind. And I'm back to Swift again. And did a little tangent over there for a while. It was great fun. I had a lot of fun doing that for 6 months. But then, hey, Swift UI is like, oh, by the way, it's declarative, no more imperative. And I think, oh, well, this is just like React. And I know some folks who've done only UIKit are like, how the hell do I do this simple thing? I'm like, oh, for me, it's like, oh, it's just like React. So it does help you a great deal stay ahead of the curve sometimes.
Yeah, and you just get to see how everybody does everything in the different ways that we all do everything too. Because we're all like, the fact that you can use JavaScript in a lot of different domains, and then you can use Python in a lot of different domains. You got to see, how would you use Python to write an iOS app? Or how would you use JavaScript to write an iOS app?
You don't, folks.
But yeah, seeing that though, it's interesting just seeing what are the different ways that you can do something, because it's like, I think programming is like math in the way that you can solve the same issue a million different ways.
Yes.
Whether or not whichever one is correct is also subjective, but you can solve it so many different ways. And just seeing how somebody else approaches a problem is so interesting, because then you get to see like different ways that you would then start approaching problems and how people get to different answers too.
It's interesting how when we hear the same discussion from other communities, we're like, oh, no, don't do that. Like when someone does that same tweet about, oh, you want to do web, JavaScript, you want to do AI, JavaScript, want to do native apps, JavaScript. Like, well, don't. Use Swift, quite frankly. And now we're like, oh, you know, AI, Swift, ML, Swift, or Swift.
And with that, I want to add one more from Yash. He mentions that being able to use it everywhere is amazing, but just because you can doesn't mean that you always should.
And with that, we come to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for listening, folks. Please leave a review if you can. Tell your friends about the episode. Next time, our open ballot's going to be, apart from coding, what is the most important skill for a developer? Until next time, folks, take care.
See ya.